Hakim, you might be a historian, but you're a good political geographer as well, just to let you know.
High praise indeed.
Yes, I'm Kate Manzo. I'm a development geographer, political geographer, with a particular focus on Africa. So I want to thank Hakim for his stimulating talk, and I certainly wouldn't presuppose to critique it in any way. If you want to critique it, that's up to you. What I want to do is two things, quite briefly. First of all, is actually just add a comment to something Hakim said about the responsibility to protect doctrine. But secondly, I want to talk about other forms that this new scramble for Africa has taken. And rather than emphasise military intervention, talk actually more about political economy and non-military forms of intervention. So in terms of the responsibility to protect doctrine, Hakim emphasised how that's been used to work in favour of so-called humanitarian intervention. And humanitarian intervention itself is a sort of key term. What it presupposes is not simply humanitarian assistance, but actual humanitarian assistance accompanied by military protection. Okay, so you know, we need to understand that. What goes under the guise of humanitarianism now often is actually military as well. But the curious thing about the responsibility to protect doctrine is that it has been used both to support intervention and to support non-intervention. So the case of Darfur is a case in point. The Save Darfur Coalition is very much in favour of military intervention. Okay, they argue that in order to prevent the continued genocide of the so-called Africans in Darfur, as opposed to the Arabs in Darfur, even though they're all Africans, you know, that there ought to be some sort of military intervention. There's an online journal called Spiked, which had an article on celebrity colonialism, they called it, in which they pointed out that celebrities like Mia Farrow were trying to raise funds to actually pay for private planes to go in and bomb the Janjaweed and, you know, put a stop to the genocide. So, you know, lots of interesting discussion we could have around that. The point there, I think, being, you know, is there too much military intervention or is there too little? What are the issues that are generating the intervention? Darfur, of course, is part of Sudan, which, as Hakim pointed out, is a big oil producer. And the government of Sudan has very strong links with China. So, you know, there is an oil-based, an energy issue related to that as well. But some people in favour of intervention into Darfur have argued that, you know, when it's only a human rights issue, then the West doesn't want to intervene. So I think, we could usefully talk about under what circumstances we might intervene. But the other point I want to make is that in my field, development studies and political economy, the new scramble for Africa actually refers to a different kind of intervention than the one that Hakim's talking about. And in particular, it doesn't refer to oil, it refers to farmland. And I'm sure you're all familiar with, you know, some of the debates around this. And why is it called a new scramble for Africa in terms of farmland? A lot of the literature on this points out that a lot of this so-called new scramble for farmland has been since the food security crisis of 2007, 2008, which also coincidentally was an energy crisis. And so I think, you know, it's important to notice what are the kind of drivers, the sort of discursive languages that go on around this new scramble for farmland. It isn't human rights, and it isn't military intervention, but it is security, okay, in two senses. First of all, food security, and secondly, energy security. And what I'm interested in my work is actually looking at how those two things intersect. And where they intersect most obviously is in biofuels debates. Because palm plantations, for example, and one of the biggest investors in palm oil production in Africa, interestingly, is not China, it's Malaysia. But the reason for acquiring palm oil plantations is precisely that you have an edible product. So palm oil is used for cooking, for example. But you also have one that has huge biofuel possibilities. Now, Malaysia is very upset at the moment because the EU actually has very strict guidelines on what kind of palm oil can be imported, what are its biofuel applications, and that has to do a lot with the whole decarbonisation agenda, okay, the whole climate change mitigation and adaptation agenda. So, yes, there are genuine concerns about food and about energy, but they often come together in this scramble over African land. And what I'm interested in as well is not just the military forces that go into these countries, but the private actors who go into these countries. Because I think, you know, colonialism, as Lenin famously said, you know, in his book, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism. Colonialism and capitalism always work together, and colonialism was never simply about foreign states, it was about foreign multinationals as well. Because where did these big plantations come from in the first place? They came from colonial investments. So there are a lot of private actors who are looking for new investment opportunities throughout Africa. Why is that contested? What is the problem with that? The problem is the kinds of lands that they're acquiring, and as Hakim eloquently looked at, you know, the consequences of that. Now, it starts to get tricky because when you don't have military forces intervening, often these things kind of slip below the radar. I'll just direct you to some websites if you want to follow up on any of this as well. StopAfricaLandGrab.com, FarmLandGrab.com. Both of those clearly have a kind of political, you know, agenda, which is very important. But one that's trying to be sort of neutral and collect lots and lots of data, so you would hate that, wouldn't you, is LandMatrix.org. But what these sorts of websites point out is that people are on these lands that are being acquired. However, just like under old-fashioned colonialism, many of them do not have land rights. Or if they assert land rights, those claims are contested. And from my research, it seems that actually most of the land that's being acquired is being leased. It is not being purchased outright. Okay? And who actually owns the land? The state, the post-colonial African state. So I think when we're looking at kind of mechanisms of colonialism, neo-colonialism, post-colonialism, we have to look at the actors involved here. And I think what makes, you know, the farmland issue so difficult in a way is we don't have military forces. We do have African states very complicit in the process. And the people themselves do not have a piece of paper that says, this is my land, get off it. Okay. So there are enormous contestations over these land claims. But the fact is that an enormous amount of land since 2007 has been acquired through leasehold by multinational corporations and others. One of the questions then, you know, this raises for me is, in a sense, you know, how do we think about these things? If we the people, you know, want to do something about this, then kind of what do we do? And I think we can certainly join, you know, the Stop Africa Land Grab Coalition. You know, we can make a noise and we can object to these things. But what I want to suggest is we also need to look at the underlying drivers of these acquisitions. Because the underlying driver of these acquisitions is global capitalism. It isn't military intervention. And what is keeping these things going is the search for resources, as Hakim said, but particular kind of resources that our decarbonisation agenda, our anti-climate change agenda, is telling us we need in order to sustain the lifestyle that is causing climate change in the first place. So I would simply argue for taking a political economy approach as well as a political geography approach to these things. Okay, thank you.